Well, good evening, and welcome to Radio Free America. I am Nip Tuck, in the studios with Dave Emery, although actually tonight this broadcast has been pre-recorded, so if you want to get in touch with us, you will not be able to do so live on the phones tonight. We are pre-recording this broadcast. But anyway, we are here with Radio Free America number 23, and we are tonight doing part two of our series of shows on terrorism, and we're going to be talking a lot more tonight about domestic terrorism. And some things that are especially highly important in this day and age of the Meese Justice Department, the possible Rehnquist Supreme Court nomination, at least nomination to Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. He's already on the court. And in general, the years of the Reagan era. We are going to be talking about, however, a program of domestic terrorism that was originally started largely in California during the Reagan years there, when Ronald Reagan was the governor of California and Ed Meese was his chief legal advisor, and was also going on in Washington, D.C., with the help of, among other people, William Rehnquist, working in the Nixon Justice Department under John Mitchell. So tonight's broadcast will be sort of a bringing it all back home version of what we started work on last month, in the last Radio Free America.
Now, on this evening's broadcast, we're going to be dealing in particular with the research of Mae Brussel. For those of you who are not familiar with Mae Brussel, Mae is the top researcher in this field, and one of the reasons, well, we will be showing you one of the reasons why, or an example of why. We're going to be dealing with a lot of Mae's work. First of all, her work is part of a group called the Citizens Research and Investigating Committee, and after that, we're going to read a good portion, almost half, of a very long article that Mae Brussel wrote in the Realist magazine dealing with the Symbionese Liberation Army. Those of you who are listening to this broadcast, when it is originally broadcast on KFJC, should be aware that if you're not already, that Mae Brussel's program is aired twice a week on this station, so you're in an excellent position to pick up on Mae's current work. What we're going to be dealing with to a considerable extent this evening, in fact, almost entirely, are the use of what are known as agent provocateur, specifically the use of agent provocateur by California police agencies and the coordination of those California police operations with elements of the FBI and the CIA, as well as quite possibly elements of the Nixon White House as well on occasion. Now, an agent provocateur is basically, it's what in English is known as a provoking agent, and that's basically what an agent provocateur does. An agent provocateur is someone who is recruited to stage some sort of outrage, a terrorist bombing or an assassination or some sort of act which will outrage the public, and the act is then blamed on the political opponent of the person who has recruited the provoking agents. And the aim is to not only discredit the political opposition, which happens through the use of this provoking agent, but more importantly, the provocation, the terrorist act, the outrage committed by the provoking agent is then used as an excuse to either crack down on the opposition or limit their abilities, their civil liberties, or whatever in considerable measure. It's a tactic that we've seen used a lot of times. We looked at it in Radio Free America number 4 in connection with the Turple Wilson case, and we've also looked at it in connection with our massive series about the Pope shooting, our 5-part Radio Free America series, numbers 17 through 21. We looked at Stefano Della Chiaia and the Strategy of Tension, which is a classic example of the use of agent provocateur. We also took a look at the use of agent provocateur in our last Radio Free America show, the first of our 2-part series about terrorism. What we're going to be doing on this broadcast is, in a sense, bringing it all back home. We're going to take a look at terrorism, and specifically, the use of agent provocateur in California while Ronald Reagan was governor. Of course, when Reagan became president of the United States, terrorism was one of the first and most frequently sounded of the themes of his administration. And we're going to take a look at, in a sense, California as sort of the test run for the Reagan administration. One might perhaps this might seem like sort of a forced comparison, but one might almost, from a conceptual standpoint, view Ronald Reagan's gubernatorial term in California as sort of like the being to Reagan's presidential term as the Spanish Civil War was to World War II and the Nazi military conquests, Hitler's military conquests. In a nutshell, as I'm sure many of the listeners are aware, many of the blitzkrieg tactics, the combined air-land operations, which were to be so devastating, at least in the early days of World War II, were first tried out on behalf of Franco's fascists in Spain. Both Hitler and Mussolini lent massive military aid to the fascist cause in the Spanish Civil War, and many of the tactics which were to literally be used to blaze a path of terror and destruction across Europe by the Third Reich first were implemented during the Spanish Civil War. One might, in a sense, and if the comparison seems forced now, I would ask listeners to suspend judgment, one might, in a sense, view the Reagan term in California as sort of a dry run for the Reagan presidential term. And we're going to be taking a look at some of the similarities between the kinds of terrorism we're seeing now in this country and all over the world with people like Muammar Gaddafi, Carlos the Jackal, whoever or whatever he may be. And we've looked at him in a couple of shows, our last Radio Free America show in number 4. And we're also going to take a look at some of the people who, in a sense, form a bridge or bridge the gap between Reagan's administration in California and Reagan's administration in Washington. As Nip indicated, Ed Meese will figure prominently in our discussion. Ed Meese was Ronald Reagan's chief legal counsel when he was a governor, and of course he is now the highest law enforcement official of the United States. He's Attorney General. William Rehnquist was an official with the Nixon Justice Department, most of whose key members wound up being indicted and in many cases convicted. That very same Nixon administration worked closely with the Reagan gubernatorial administration in California to stage many of the incidents and the provocations we're going to be talking about. And as Nip indicated quite appropriately, we're going to be looking at some of the bridges between these two.
Indeed. And just to, again, put this in perspective for those listeners who might not be as familiar with some of this material, the subject of the agent provocateur is sometimes a little challenging because, again, it is something that is happening that is quite often not at all evident at the time, and it flies directly in the face of what is being handed across through the media, sometimes involuntarily on the part of the media, sometimes not, as the facts. And, of course, this is the precise reason why the agent provocateur is used. It's an old historical gambit. It goes way back into the depths of documented history, back probably all the way to the Sumerians and the Chaldeans and the Babylonians, certainly into the days of ancient Egypt and ancient Rome, all the way up to the present. And the most important thing to realize in our examination tonight of the agent provocateur is that one of the ways in which they are useful is that the winner always writes the history. If the Third Reich had won and Fortress Europe was still standing, it would still be common historical knowledge that the Reichstag was burnt down by Martinus von der Lubbe, a communist who was trying to undo the good work of the Nazis. And it would still be established historical fact that the Poles had started World War II, when in fact, of course, as we now know, it was a bunch of Jewish slave laborers and prisoners who were driven into Poland and dressed up in Polish army uniforms and slaughtered to give the Nazis a flimsy excuse to breach the Polish border. So those who write history oftentimes make history. In fact, make it oftentimes where there is no fact to support the history that they make. And this is where the agent provocateur comes in very usefully. And in fact, if we do not keep our eyes open, some of the things that we are being told today that already, stories that already have large cracks in them, if we do not explore these cracks and attempt to get to the real truth behind them, may go on to become established truth. Gaddafi, things of this nature may go on as the history of tomorrow in the thousand-year Reich of the Reagan administration. Who knows? We hope not. And to that point, we're going to do our best tonight to at least unpeel a little bit more of the surface and try and get a little bit more to the subject matter beneath. The first segment we're going to read tonight is going to be a short section from the book The Glass House Tapes, subtitled The Story of an Agent Provocateur and the New Police Intelligence Complex by Citizens Research and Investigation Committee and Lewis E. Tackwood. The CRIC, who wrote this book, contained, among other people, Mabe Russell, whose work was instrumental in putting together this book, and also Donald Freed, a man whose book Death in Washington and some of his other writings we have praised and used often on this broadcast.
Also a man named Ron Ridenour, and we're going to take a look at an article, actually a guest editorial column, in the Oakland Tribune written by Ron Ridenour many years after the CRIC concluded its work. And Ron was in on the original investigation of the criminal conspiracy section and the allegations which were substantiated of Lewis Tackwood. Before Nip reads, we're just to tell you a little bit about the criminal conspiracy section. As Tackwood himself is, oh, by the way, the book is called The Glass House Tapes because Lewis Tackwood, who was an undercover informant and agent provocateur for part of the Los Angeles Police Department called the Criminal Conspiracy Section, or CCS, Tackwood sat down with members of the CRIC and made a long series of tapes, an excerpt of which Nip is about to read you. It's worth noting, and it'll be covered in great detail in the passages we're going to be reading, that the Criminal Conspiracy Section of the Los Angeles Police Department acted as a sort of a super spy agency and agent provocateur agency. It not only operated all over the state of California, well outside of the legal jurisdiction of the Los Angeles Police Department, it actually operated outside of the state of California and did so in conjunction with elements of the FBI and the CIA, as well as elements of the Nixon White House. That's a key point to remember.
Indeed. And reading again from Lewis Tackwood's book, the book The Glass House Tapes is published 1973 in paperback by Avon. And Lewis Tackwood here is telling in his own first-person voice his first contact with the criminal conspiracy section. Quote, "My first meeting was held at the Glass House on the third floor, where I met the head man in charge of a new department called Criminal Conspiracy Section. His name is Lieutenant Keel, K-E-E-L. His partner was a Sergeant Sherritt, S-H-E-R-R-E-T-T. Before they started talking, they gave me $100. Lieutenant Keel said, 'Listen, man, you're just the man we want. You have all the experience we need. Stop working for SII and come to work for us.' I said, 'Well, yeah, the money looks good. Who are you?' Keel said, 'Criminal Conspiracy Section.' I found out later that's just what they're doing, too. They spend all their time cooking up criminal conspiracies against militants, particularly groups like the Panthers, Angela Davis, and people like that. And as we will find out, as Lewis Tackwood took his sort of Alice in Wonderland journey through the Glass House, there was more than merely a conspiracy against a few militants that was going on at the criminal conspiracy section. In fact, they were part of a larger conspiracy against the civil rights of a somewhat feisty and troublesome American people."
Now, the first CCS operations, the first criminal conspiracy section operations we're going to be looking at here, involved the deep sixing of various militant black organizations in California and actions against various individuals who were active on behalf of black civil rights during the 60s and 70s in California. The first individual and organization that we're going to be looking at here is one which is very relevant to this day. We're going to take a look at a group called U.S., which does not stand for United States, it stands for United Slaves. And the organization was headed up by a man named Ron Karenga, K-A-R-E-N-G-A. Karenga, just like Tackwood, appears to have been an agent provocateur, that is, a conscious agent of the U.S. police and national security establishment. That notwithstanding, Karenga has gone on to become a leading figure in the black community, and specifically, it was Ron Karenga who generated the Black Solstice Festival of Kwanzaa. And I think I speak for Nip on this. We're in no way passing judgment on the celebration of Kwanzaa itself. Basically, an African-oriented solstice festival, such as Christmas or Hanukkah or something like that. However, Ron Karenga, the man who first generated the idea and has garnered a lot of favorable publicity from this, was, and quite possibly still is, basically an intelligence agent for California police, the California police elements, as well as someone who operated on behalf of the U.S. National Security Establishment. And again, reading from the Glass House Tapes by the CRIC and Lewis Tackwood. And again, quoting a direct section from one of the Glass House Tapes. By the way, the Glass House is the Los Angeles police headquarters where the criminal conspiracy section was housed. And that's the reference to the Glass House here. Again, quoting here from Tackwood. "My first assignment with CCS was when I was liaison between CCS and Ron Karenga's organization, U.S. I contacted Ron Karenga and gave him orders to the effect that was given to me that he was to curtail the Panther Party's growth no matter what it cost, and that no orangutan, that's what we call those people, will ever be convicted of murder. This is from the horse's mouth, by one man. His name is Eddie Watkins. We were rapping about the war that was going on between the Panthers and U.S. Watkins said we'd better stop giving that Karenga, that mad dog, orders to kill off Panthers, or we're going to have a bloodbath on our hands in Los Angeles. Now, Brown says, let the niggers kill each other off, and we're going to sit here and kill the rest of them. That's the best way to do it. Okay, Watson says, yeah, man, but it's costing us too much money. Okay, that was the money part of it. And by the way, if some of these references don't seem clear immediately, Tackwood himself was a very streetwise, or is a very streetwise individual, and spoke in a street tone here. And so some of it may not, some passages of the actual Glasshouse tapes may seem a little obscure. The point here being that Karenga and his U.S. organization was working hand in glove with Tackwood and the Criminal Conspiracy Section to eliminate the Black Panthers. Then the CRIC goes on to elaborate. During the same period of rising police violence against blacks, the increasing militance in the community was creating political divisions which were leading to violent clashes between blacks. The two major political positions to emerge were revolutionary nationalism, unquote, the leading exponent of which was the Black Panther Party, and cultural nationalism, unquote, expounded by the organization U.S., United Slaves, led by Ron Karenga. The revolutionary nationalists saw that the source of their oppression was the prevailing social, prevailing political and economic system. They were socialists and were willing to make alliances with radical whites in working for a radical transformation of society. On the other hand, the cultural nationalists saw black liberation solely as a struggle of black against white. They stressed traditional African culture rather than a specific political program and, as was the case with Karenga, were often militantly anti-communist. Cultural nationalism was thus finally reactionary and entirely consistent with a program of black capitalism, unquote, put forward by Nixon and other establishment politicians, which would allow the admission of a few blacks into the ruling circles of American society without changing the nature of the oppression faced by the great masses of black people. The growing antagonisms between these two positions reached a crisis point in the struggle for leadership of the black student movement at UCLA. The issue which served as the catalyst in the fight was the choice of a director for the newly created Campus Afro-American Studies Center. A coalition of black community groups was created by the Black Students Union on campus to aid in the choice of the director. Ron Karenga of U.S., who was not a UCLA student, managed initially to get the coalition to accept a nominee whom he supported for the post, and he urged that an ultimatum be served on the UCLA administration to have this nominee appointed. However, the Black Panther faction, led by John Huggins and Al Prentice Bunchy Carter, who were UCLA students and were widely respected on campus, succeeded in rallying students to hold back on the choice and try to look for other potential nominees. On January 17, 1969, a particularly bitter and stormy meeting on this question was held in UCLA's Campbell Hall. As the meeting was breaking up, shooting broke out, and John Huggins and Bunchy Carter were killed. Subsequently, the Los Angeles County Grand Jury indicted five U.S. members for murder and conspiracy in the killings. Ron Karenga was not present when the killings occurred and was not indicted. Three of the five were ultimately apprehended, convicted of second-degree murder, and sentenced to life imprisonment. Tackwood claims that Karenga was given money, guns, narcotics, and encouragement from the police in his war with the Panthers. This is not inconsistent with Karenga's known record of opportunism in dealing with the white power structure, unquote, he professed to despise. According to the Wall Street Journal, quote, a few weeks after the assassination of Martin Luther King, Mr. Karenga slipped into Sacramento for a private chat with Governor Reagan at the governor's request. The black nationalist also met clandestinely with Los Angeles Police Chief Thomas Redden after Mr. King was killed, unquote. Since the exposure of U.S.'s role in the murder of Carter and Huggins, Karenga's influence in the black community has waned. His usefulness to the police has thus declined. He was recently arrested and charged with the torture of two black women whom he claimed were trying to poison him. He was subsequently convicted and sentenced to 1 to 10 years in prison. I would add, obviously, that in the years since the Glasshouse tapes was published, that came out in 73, Karenga's influence within the black community has obviously begun to rise again. The point here being that Karenga, his United Slaves organization, was used as a tool by the Criminal Conspiracy Section in order to murder Black Panthers and to erode their influence within the black community. And as Tackwood indicated here, his first assignment for CCS was as the liaison between Criminal Conspiracy Section and the United Slaves of Ron Karenga.
And I would also just add that any of our listeners, if we don't get a chance to discuss it in detail tonight, there are It's possible to go to most bookstores or libraries and find a copy of the FBI's declassified COINTELPRO program, which basically was a J. Edgar Hoover blueprint for destroying black political resistance in this country. And the tone that bleeds through that government document, with its government document language, is one of absolute and extreme paranoia, talking about at all costs preventing the rise of a quote-unquote black messiah, and then with a bunch of names that have been since excised out, Martin Luther King being one of them, pretty obvious from the context, Malcolm X being mentioned as being dead, I believe, also obvious from the context, and a variety of other names mentioned, some of whom were most likely Black Panther figures of the time. But again, if one needs some sort of psychic confirmation of the kind of the mood in the structures of government at that time, one should just read the language of the COINTELPRO program document proposal, or whatever you want to call it, to realize how scared the police and FBI were running at the time. Reading another segment from the Glass House tapes, and the words again of Lewis Tackwood. Tackwood says, "Now this Cotton Smith, his name is Melvin Smith, was the number three man in the Panthers in Los Angeles. Is the same thing as I am from way back. I'll tell you, Melvin Cotton, before he was anything, little old half-wit, he had a coke habit, freak, and he messed around there with those little girls, and somebody gave him up. He started sales of narcotics for them, and so they hooked this thing up with CCS, and Cotton knew the same things that I did. He was there first, and that's all. So they put Cotton in there, gave him carte blanche. Cotton was working for intelligence. Actually, CCS didn't get a hold of Cotton until 2 months before the big blowout over there. The Panthers had a stash of guns in Compton, which they were moving down to L.A. Before that, they had a big meeting. See where I'm coming from? Cotton helped instigate the idea. Let's shoot him out, baby. Now, every big Panther was supposed to be there, including G. And in parentheses, it says Elmer Pratt, known as Geronimo. Now, what they were going to do, kill them all, kill as many as we can, and the rest of them dead anyway. But it didn't work like that. It took them just a little longer than they thought it would." Well, again, as Dave mentioned, Lewis Tackwood in his street argo is sometimes a little difficult to follow. What he's talking about here, though, is the CCS basically getting Cotton Smith, number three man in the Los Angeles Panthers, to instigate something with a stash of guns being moved down to Los Angeles, to give the police a chance, an excuse to break it up shooting and to kill as many Panthers as possible. The mention of Geronimo Pratt is interesting also, because of course Geronimo Pratt was just recently turned down in his bid to have his case reopened. Geronimo Pratt is currently in jail on what he says is a trumped up charge. Again, the evidence that we will be looking at tonight of this type of activity, and certainly the evidence that was presented, at least that I saw, in the newspapers by Geronimo Pratt's attorneys, tend to suggest that indeed he probably was just another victim of this particular criminal conspiracy section way of doing business, namely to either shoot the black activists or to get them hung up on framed charges and thrown in jail. Geronimo Pratt was unable to get this retrial. The reasoning, I don't recall exactly, but it was basically something to the effect of that, well, we don't believe that your evidence is good enough. We think it's hearsay.
What Geronimo Pratt and his counsel were claiming was that FBI wiretaps of Panther headquarters would have shown that he was not, I believe it was in Los Angeles at the time. I believe Pratt's claim was that he was in Oakland at the time that he supposedly was committing a murder in Los Angeles.
You're
and
correct.
That FBI wiretaps of the Oakland Black Panther Party headquarters would have demonstrated this. Though the logs of those wiretaps were destroyed, and because of that, the judge claimed that there was no proof that Geronimo Pratt was not where he was said by the jury to have been. And beyond that, there was no indication that the FBI was actively interfering with Geronimo Pratt in any way. His counsel had also claimed that agents had infiltrated the Panthers and that they were largely responsible for setting up his situation.
And as a matter of fact, if I remember correctly, the COINTELPRO, the declassified COINTELPRO documents, was one of the things that was introduced by Pratt's attorneys,
mm-hmm.
Which the court found manifestly unimpressive for some reason. And also that the thing with the tapes, now that you remind me, was it was a very specific set of tapes that happened to be exactly the two-week period that he was talking about that had disappeared, that in fact those were the ones that had, as you said, either the records had been destroyed or the tapes had been destroyed, but it was not the whole program of tapes. It was the one specifically relating to Geronimo Pratt's claim. Again, one of those wild historical coincidences.
One of the most famous incidents involving black militants, prison activism, and tragedy, and apparently also the use of agent provocateur, concerns the attempted escape from San Quentin of George Jackson, one of the so-called Soledad brothers. George Jackson and a number of other black inmates had become very active in organizing and raising the political consciousness of black inmates in California prisons during the 60s and 1970s. George Jackson was reportedly Angela Davis's lover, and Jackson had also become, as I said, something of a leader in the prison reform movement in California. He died during an alleged escape attempt in San Quentin, and it now appears that that escape attempt was set up by the authorities. It was, in essence, a provocation, and recently in California, Stephen Bingham, who was George Jackson's attorney, was acquitted for allegedly attempting to aid that alleged escape attempt.
It should be mentioned, too, that this is particularly an important part to pay attention to, because not just, again, because of the recent local reference, namely the Bingham acquittal, which aided in casting doubt on the official story, but the fact that it concerns the intersection of the radical movement in California and the California prison system, because as we're going to see later on, specifically in the long section from Mae Brussels' article on the Symbionese Liberation Army, that particular intersection between those two things, and in fact it came from the radical movement when the radicals began to be locked up and began talking politics with the other prisoners, in many cases radicalizing or at least politicizing the prisoners, that the California police and government authorities began taking an interest in the prisons, however, not the kind of interests that most of the prisoners would have liked, and the prison system itself became a sort of a testing grounds for a new breed of psychological warfare cooked up by the California state government.
Okay, now we're going to take a look at some of the curious aspects of the alleged escape attempt by George Jackson and his death during that alleged attempt. And as indicated before, this appears to have been a setup, and there are a lot of indications that the authorities wanted Jackson to do just what he is supposed to have done in order to kill him. Whether Jackson was duped into attempting an escape which was doomed from the start, or whether the entire thing was something of a fabrication, is not totally clear. It is clear, however, that this was not a spontaneous escape attempt and was a provocation. And it might even, the escape attempt itself might have been a total fabrication on the part of the authorities. That's unclear. However, that the authorities were actively working to set this up is quite apparent, and some of the indications of that are related by the CRIC in the Glasshouse tapes. They write as follows. The killing here, by the way, is the killing of George Jackson during this escape attempt. 2 days after the killing, prison officials leaked, unquote, to the press that they had other evidence to indicate Jackson had been planning an escape. According to the leak, Jackson and James Carr, Jackson's Soledad cellmate who had been released, exchanged letters regarding an escape plan, and the letters had been discovered by a dry cleaning firm in some trousers Carr was having cleaned. The letters were turned over to the authorities, photostated, and returned to the trousers. Given this forewarning, it is incredible that prison officials could have committed the security lapses necessary to make their escape story hold up. The official autopsy report raises further questions about the official version. The preliminary report indicated Jackson was killed by a bullet entering the head and exiting through his back. However, on September 21st, 1 month after his death, the final official autopsy report was released showing that the bullet actually entered the back and exited through the head. When asked how a bullet fired from 20 feet above could follow such a trajectory, prison officials said that Jackson was running in a crouch, and that since he was over 270 feet away from the guard who fired the fatal shot, the bullet was traveling almost horizontally. However, the bullet would still have had to be traveling at a slight downward angle, and the downward angle would increase due to the force of gravity the further the bullet traveled. There are many witnesses of prison life. Quote, and interrupting here, they're quoting a former San Quentin inmate. My name is Michael McCarthy. I spent 7 years under the custody of the California Department of Corrections in Soledad, San Quentin, the California Men's Colony, and Tracy. In order to understand what's happening in prisons today, you have to understand that the cutting line of division in this country of any kind of progressive political movement is racism. As long as they can keep the Chicanos over there, the blacks over there, and the working class and poor whites over here, you can forget about any kind of unified movement. Anytime you have someone in the prison starting to move in a political way to cut through the color line, you can be sure that the prison authorities are going to come down on him, and the chances are they'll use racism to do it. So you have a constant situation where the prison administration is always baiting black and white and Chicano against one another. As an example, usually what would happen is that they would take an undesirable black and put him in the immediate area of those whites who would be most interested in killing blacks, arming the whites with knives and not the blacks. This happened in 1968 to Dopey Dan in O Wing in Soledad, where he was cut out on the exercise tier with five white dudes who were armed, and he was killed within 15 or 20 minutes. I don't know how many stab wounds he suffered. And of course, the prison authorities had tried to kill George Jackson many times before his death. They had been trying to kill George ever since the original incident 10 or 11 years ago in Tracy, when George took a seat in the white section in the segregated TV room and a riot ensued. He was transferred to San Quentin, and from that point on, they constantly tried to find whites to kill him. Matter of fact, the statement made by Al Mancino, who was one of the prisoners shot in the leg the day George was killed, stated that he had been approached by certain white correctional officials and told that he would be given a parole and released from prison if he would set up the murder of George Jackson.
Continuing on with the Glass House Tapes, same section. Another case took place in Soledad, shortly after George and the other two Soledad brothers had been indicted in the murder of that prison guard, when they approached two or three guys who formerly had been Nazis. I think Marvin Snuffy Smith was one of them, and told them that they would be paroled if they would, in fact, kill George. And they went to George and told him what happened, that they had been approached. But at that time, the climate in prison had changed enough so that whites were beginning to snap as to how they were being used. That doesn't mean that these whites were political in the same sense as we normally think of being radical or revolutionary. They had just come to the realization that they were being used as cannon fodder, and that their position in relation to the prison administration and to the situation in society at large was more on a class perspective than on a race perspective. This increasing political understanding on the part of all prisoners, whether they be black, Chicano, or white, has led to a situation where it has become difficult for prison authorities to use racism as a means of dealing with undesirable elements, unquote. On October 1st, the Marin County Grand Jury indicted six black and brown San Quentin inmates on murder and other charges relating to the alleged escape attempt. The indictments were based solely on testimony of prison officials. Also indicted was Stephen Bingham, who, by virtue of allegedly smuggling the gun to Jackson, was also charged with murder. However, Bingham has not been heard from since the day of his friend's death. He was last seen by his uncle, a retired Berkeley professor, at about 5 p.m. on that day. His uncle described him as being very relaxed and normal, not the demeanor of a man who has just participated in a prison escape attempt. In spite of the obvious incredibility of the official version of George Jackson's death, it appears that there will be no independent official investigation to look at the facts that point to a different version. An affidavit signed by 27 inmates of the Adjustment Center and smuggled out of San Quentin charges that Jackson was murdered by prison authorities who then concocted the prison escape story as a cover-up. There is also evidence that in the past, prison officials had tried to bring about Jackson's death. On March 19th, an attorney for the Soledad brothers took a statement from a white convict, Alan Mancino, who was imprisoned at Soledad at the same time as Jackson. Mancino claimed that in January 1970, a prison captain asked him directly to kill Jackson. Mancino's affidavit stated that he was blindfolded and addressed by a voice he recognized as that of Captain Moody. Mancino has said, quote, "Moody began to address me and asked how I liked being among the niggers on the second tier, and asked how I felt about George Jackson specifically. Moody then asked me directly if I would kill George Jackson. He said that he did not want another Eldridge Cleaver." Mancino refused to cooperate and was then intimidated by a, quote, hypothetical situation described by Moody in which he would be taken out into the yard one night and shot when he, quote, made a break for the fence. Mancino understood that if he did not kill Jackson, he himself might be killed. Several days later, he was transferred to another prison. Then in parentheses it says, On the day five months later when George Jackson was shot while, quote, making a break for the fence at San Quentin, Mancino was an inmate on the same tier. Along with other prisoners, he was stretched naked and chained to the ground. He was singled out and shot by a guard, allowed to lie bleeding on the floor for an hour, and then illegally transferred to a jail in Nevada where he is being kept incommunicado as a potential witness for the prosecution. And again, since this book was written in 1973, we're not quite sure what happened to Alan Mancino. We do know what happened to Stephen Bingham, as we mentioned earlier. He surfaced after some 17 years, still claiming his innocence, went to court, and while a lot of very interesting information was not allowed to be brought into court, nonetheless, enough information was brought in that Stephen Bingham was, in fact, acquitted of the conspiracy to help an escape attempt. Another interesting source that I just bumped into the other day that you might want to check out since it's in most libraries is a book by Jessica Mitford, the well-known journalist who wrote, among other things, The American Way of Dying, a book, sort of an autobiographical book about her writing, mainly, called Confessions of a Muckraker. And one of the things in there is an interview that she did with George Jackson some 6 or 8 months before his death. And in the interview, Jackson comes off as being a person very much aware that his life is in danger. He says specifically that they're going to kill me. You know, they're determined to kill me. They're taking bets with each other on how long I'm going to last. You know, they're going to make it look like an escape attempt or a riot or something like that, or it's going to be during a prison riot. But he seemed very positive, angry about it, as a matter of fact, because there was very little he could do. And he described in some detail the kinds of things that he was up against in the system. And with the benefit of hindsight, it's really pretty frightening to go back and read how sure George Jackson was about what was going to happen to him and how absolutely right he was in his prophecy about how he would be done in.
Again, the very suspicious alleged note from James Carr, we're going to see what happened to James Carr here a little later, the alleged suspicious note from James Carr to George Jackson, the curious information concerning the wound that killed George Jackson, making it appear as if he was lying on the ground, similar to the inmate Mancino that Nip just read you about, the many, many attempts previously on the part of prison authorities and the police to get rid of George Jackson, and the subsequent acquittal of Stephen Bingham, as well as some other information we're going to look at here, lend massive credence to George Jackson's claim. And obviously, his claim was prophecy, as it turned out. Now, the next criminal conspiracy section, conspiracy, that we're going to be looking at here, concerns the death of Jonathan Jackson, rather, George Jackson's brother, in a shootout at the Marin County Courthouse in San Rafael. Supposedly, Jonathan Jackson, rather, was attempting to take some hostages and force the release of his brother George. And as we're going to see here, this outrage also was set up by the criminal conspiracy section. Again, quoting directly from Tackwood's Glasshouse tapes. I had been transferred from intelligence to CCS, but in the process we found out a few things about a Northern California-type conspiracy thing. At the time, Angela Davis wasn't even being thought about. What they were worried about was that information was coming down from the North that the blacks and whites and Chicanos were getting together and recombining into one faction. At the time, Angela Davis was doing a lot of speaking all over the campuses. Some of the people she knew were involved in this combining of the groups. So I was asked to go north and check it out. But in the process, we found that Angela Davis was heavily involved in the Soledad defense case. Interrupting, of course, George Jackson was the best known of the Soledad brothers. So they started tailing her because they knew before she was going north that she was going. At the same time, they had been getting wind down here and some up there that there was going to be some kind of breakout. So it was coincidental that the first person Angela Davis visited up north was one of the main characters in the little old plot. She's not involved, but they were. When she got there, the planning had already been formulated. The main person in the plot was Cotton Smith. Interrupting, that's the Melvin Smith referred to in an earlier passage, and working for criminal conspiracy section. Beginning again, the main person in the plot was Cotton Smith. Cotton being the number one gun expert in all those things, and had already shipped guns up there, and he was the liaison man between the North, Santa Cruz, and here. So the police knew who was there, when they were there, and how. So the police had a very wide picture of what was going on. The way it went down was not the way it was supposed to happen. The way they were going to do it, if you notice the way Marin County is set up, the chief of police, the mayor, all of them are in the same building. Well, 9 men could run in there, go into the building right quick, and just take over. But that morning, some of the members went to San Rafael, and they'd seen that there was too many police that morning, so they split, leaving Jonathan Jackson out there sitting by himself, and you could imagine what went through his mind. He walks up there with the guns, not knowing the rest of them had gone, and the expletive deleted hit the fan. Angela all this time is in San Jose, so like when she hears the news over the radio, she splits. She leaves San Francisco and comes back to Los Angeles, and from there she splits. Now, the police is right there on her all the time, but by the time she gets to Los Angeles, the APBs, all-point bulletins, are out for her, so she splits. And, again, obviously, CCS and the authorities knew about this attempt beforehand, and Cran Cotton Smith, an agent for the police, was very much involved in setting it up. I think a point should be made about provocations, that the best kind of a provocation, obviously, any provocation will entail the use of infiltrators and agents, but the best kind is one in which you get some sincere fanatics and dupe them into doing what you want to. And it appears that in the Marin County scenario, that is what happened.
And, of course, one of the reasons is that, as sometimes does happen, there are people out there who will investigate. There are people out there like the scads of dedicated researchers who have written reams and reams about, say, the problems with the Kennedy assassination, official theories or whatever. So whenever possible, as Dave mentioned, if you can get an honest-to-goodness, real-life fanatic to do it, at least you've got the background solid, a checkable, traceable background. And if you can just obscure your connection to that person, then you have apparently another nut or another political fanatic or another religious nut or whatever the case may be with impeccable credentials to bear the brunt of the blame for the act.
Now, what we're going to take a look at next is exactly how the criminal conspiracy section was able to obscure its connection with James Carr. Now, recall, James Carr was George Jackson, not Jonathan Jackson, the person who just died in the person whose death in the Marin County shootout we just talked about. But George Jackson was the fellow who died in the escape attempt, the actual Soledad brother. And recall that James Carr was his former cellmate and the man who allegedly wrote this escape attempt, this escape note proposing this alleged escape attempt. And we're going to see, we're about to take a look at some information, not only further corroborating the fact that CCS set up the alleged attempt of George Jackson to escape, which of course resulted in his death, but we're also going to take a look at what happened to James Carr shortly afterward.
And again, bear in mind that so often happens with these people, we've talked about the fact that Sirhan, Artie Bremmer, John David Hinckley, all the lone nuts like to keep diaries.
John Warnock Hinckley.
Oh, yes. And we've got all kinds of other interesting things. In this case, we've got James Carr, a man who is helping to supposedly break out one of the most important political resistors or political criminals or dangerous men or whatever in the United States, writes the escape attempt plans down, puts them in letters, and then just happens to send the letters in his pants to the dry cleaners. Again, one of those little facts of history that any one of them individually, you might say, well, yeah, history is serendipitous sometimes. But when we're talking about these kinds of political assassinations or political killings, we're expected to believe 20 or 30 or 40 coincidences per killing, which is a little much. Anyway, on the subject of Mr. Carr, Mr. Jackson et al., and reading more from Lewis Tackwood's tapes, the Glass House tapes. I got to CCS around 1 o'clock. Only person who was there was Bob Sherritt. This is Tackwood, of course, talking about Sherritt, his boss. He had just walked in. We walked in together. So I said, hey, Bob, they finally got old George Jackson, huh? He said, oh, man, we've known about that for months, that breakout thing. We broke their code a long time ago. We even knew the day it was going to happen. I got to thinking myself, knowing them, they would have told CII, who would have told the prison people to be on the lookout for it. So therefore, all that stuff they found in George Jackson's cell couldn't have been there. He was set up completely. And the CRIC authors write, on April 6, 1972, James Carr, Lewis Tackwood's brother-in-law and the former cellmate of George Jackson, was murdered in San Jose. The Los Angeles Times headlined, Theft of Angela Davis Funds Linked to Slaying in San Jose. The Herald Examiner headlined, Angela Lover's Pal Gunned Down. While the approach was different, the intention was the same, to link Angela Davis through guilt by association to another killing.